Black mask, I'm a nuisance, pounding a plan, trying to be Bruce Wayne. I ain't slowed down since about last May, cause this grind don't sleep and I dream all day. And I'm far from sane, cursed with a gift, my only saving grace. Firstborn son, and they think I'm crazy, till the sky falls and they see my rain. First thing, they don't know about the vision, no wonder why there's all eyes on me. Came from a place where the grass ain't green, so the blood, sweat and tears really stain my tea. And I can't find sleep, always awake, guess it ain't that deep. Everywhere I go, I'm just counting sheep, so I gotta lead the way like little Bo Peep on the kid. Certain man wanna lean on a kid, cause I mapped out the plan, they can't see what it is. And they try to take a mile from an inch, with the game in my hand, hit the three in a clinch. Clutch, so it's either bust or go bust, try to skip my turn till I doubled on Dutch. If this goose don't land, then someone best up. Black mask, I'm a nuisance, pounding a plan, trying to be Bruce Wayne. I ain't slowed down since about last May, cause this grind don't sleep and I dream all day. And I'm far from sane, cursed with a gift, my only saving grace. Firstborn son, and they think I'm crazy, till the sky falls and they see my rain.
Wait, all these paths and it led to pain. Straight. My name's Stuart, I'm the founder of Since 71, and I'm pleased to be back recording after a short break. Today I'm joined by Ajani from Threelance Media. Ajani has recently produced a 5-episode series titled Throwing the Kitchen Sink, which is available to stream now over on YouTube. Each episode focuses on important issues affecting the women's game, including sexism and sexuality, broadcasting issues, black representation, agency and professionalism, and equal pay. If you've not watched them yet, then I fully encourage you to do so, although you don't need to have seen the series to enjoy this episode. It works well as an intro or Attenborough-style making of to complement it. But before I jump into my conversation with Ajani, I just want to play you a short clip from episode 1 featuring Coach Ali, as found on Twitter. She talks about sexism in women's football and how it affected her at a young age.
I mean, I guess my very first experience was when I was about 9 or 10 years old at primary school. So I used to play like in the playground at lunchtimes with the boys. I used to play football every playtime. And they went and asked the school teacher, like the, I think he was the deputy head, but he was the head of the football's boy, like boys football team, could I play in the school matches? And he was just like, no. And they were like, but sir, she's good. Like, why can't she play? And he was like, she's a girl. But that was, and at that time, so that was like, I started secondary school in 94, so this would have been around 92, 93. It wasn't even a conversation. Like, my little 10-year-old self didn't have the confidence to be like, hang on a minute, like, that's sexist. I was just, that was just accepted as the answer was, no, she can't play because she's a girl. So that would have been like my very first experience really of sexism in football.
Thank you for taking the time to sit down and talk to me. And apologies, we've had to postpone a couple of times. That's the life of being a parent of a 15-month-old in the midst of COVID, while also trying to maintain a day job and also coach a youth football team. So I'm spinning a lot of plates, but I'm really glad to actually have a chance to sit down and talk to you and find out more about a series that I thought was brilliant. To be blunt.
Thank you for having me. Like, as soon as you contacted me about doing this, it's something I wanted to be a part of straight away. And no, don't worry about postponing anything, that's fine. Like, life gets in the way sometimes. As we start talking about the documentary, we'll get into how much life got in the way of interviews and whatnot anyway, so it's absolutely fine.
Yeah, these sort of projects do come with their challenges. But how are you keeping? Have you been keeping enduring COVID and balancing working the day job and producing content?
It's been all right. I'm back in Birmingham now. I was in London for around 5 years or so, but due to COVID and circumstances around that, I've had to move back to Birmingham. But I'm okay. I can't complain. Still producing content here and there. Still working within the space of football and women's football and all that good stuff. So I'm not too bad.
So if we start talking about football before we go into your series,
What were your sort of first experiences of football? Were you, are you someone that used to play? I've coached for 20 years. I only played for a small amount of time for organised teams. Most of my time was kicking a ball around the park because I wasn't particularly good. Hence why it's the old expression, those who can teach, but those who can do. Hence why I've been coaching for 20 years. But I managed to get a few trophies and learn a few things on the way. So I feel like I'm giving something, even if it wasn't that from a player perspective. But what about yourself?
Yeah, so I am an avid football fan. Used to play a lot more than I do now when I was younger. I still do play here and there. But yeah, big Arsenal fan. I do follow Leicester Women, especially this year. I do have a strong affinity towards them as well as Lewis Football Club. So, yeah, I have always been interested in football, always knew in some capacity I wanted to work within football. But when I was younger, I never wanted to be a player. A lot of the kids in my year growing up always wanted to be players. But that I knew that was something I didn't want for myself. So I was always able to enjoy football in any capacity. But, yeah, I've always had a strong affection towards football.
Did you have a favourite position?
Favourite position, centre mid. And then I'd probably say centre back, but I'm always rolled between centre back and right back in my playing days. I didn't get too much time at centre mid. I guess I wasn't good enough for that position.
Hey, too much pressure there. You're probably better off from that one. You touched on something that I find quite interesting. And I don't know if you have a similar experience, but in a men's game, I'm a Man United fan for my sins. But in the women's game, I have a soft spot for Portsmouth being my local team. I have a little bit of a soft spot for Manchester United because of the transition from men's to women's game. But my experience in women's football had already started before Man United women's team had launched. And the more I work with different clubs, the more I hold different clubs to quite high affection. Did you find through making the series that you spoke to so many people that you think, well, actually, I support all of these clubs? On Sunday afternoon, I'm turning their notifications on for all of them individually, all of their teams. You buy into the women's game as a whole.
Yeah, 100%. My loyalty towards different players and different teams is stretched on a weekly basis, especially during recording. Because obviously we spoke to Amber Stubbs, for example, who was at Crystal Palace last year, and now she's just joined Watford. Spoke to Jay Pennock, who was at Sheffield. Spoke to Natasha Flint, who's at Leicester. And then obviously we spent the day down at Lewis FC with Maggie Murphy and some of the players there as well. So each of these players and then the teams, there's always an affinity or an attachment towards these teams. So it's not even a situation of I'll put one team over the other. I just want to see them all do well. I know at some stage in the season, that's not possible for everyone to succeed because they have to play each other at some point. But it's hard for me to say my heart's set on just one team in women's football. Whereas in men's, it's very hard for me to say I know the team's on the same level as Arsenal, for example.
I have zero interest in watching any men's football match other than Man United games. But from a women's perspective, I'll watch any game. So you've obviously been an Arsenal men's fan for many years, but what was it that brought you into the women's side of the game?
I think, if I'm being totally honest, it was just a lack of understanding of women's football as a whole. When I was younger, the only time I was exposed to women's football was the Women's FA Cup. And that usually used to have Arsenal women and whoever had reached the final that year against them. So that was the only women's football I was really exposed to. So from that perspective, I thought I would love to know more about it. Documentaries has always been something I've been interested in. And I was like, women's football documentaries. Well, originally, Throwing the Kitchen Sink was supposed to cover a lot more than just football. But as I was networking and talking to different people, I seemed to be drawn towards women's football the most. Obviously, women's football is a lot popular in more recent times than it has been for a long time. So I did just naturally go towards that avenue of women's sport. But yeah, it was pretty much just a lack of knowledge in terms of players, for example, who's the best team, stuff like that. Obviously, I did hear about Chelsea women, Man City women, Arsenal women, but beyond that, what kind of stories do you get from the players that are there? What kind of rivalries have they got going on? To refer to a point you mentioned earlier, Man United didn't have a women's team up until a few years ago. So I wanted to know a bit more about that. And those are the kind of stories that I wanted to investigate. So I thought, this is something, if it interests me, there must be more people like me who are interested and want to know why or what stories are within women's football. So that's how it started, essentially.
Sounds awesome. I know in episode one, you speak to Drew from Half Football Hub, who I think is a fantastic guy and someone that I'm really pleased to call a friend. And when they launched Half Football Hub, they had a very similar goal as to ourselves at Since 71. And that is just to share the stories of the people involved within. So that's the current and former players, the clubs, the fans, the managers and coaches, because there are so many stories there and they're getting almost lost and neglected. And I figured that if I don't know who these people are, how can somebody else be expected to know who these people are? And where can I go to learn about these people? And there really was a massive gap in the market. It's getting better, a lot better. The WSL gets fantastic coverage nationally as well as the international football. However, there is still gaps within the championship coverage and further down. The third tier of women's football, the National League, is where my real love is. And that's one of the areas that I think really needs to kind of be highlighted and boosted over the coming years. And with the introduction of the National League board, I'm hopeful that's something that we're definitely going to see. But just before we go into talking about the series, I understand that, like myself, you've got a day job that you have to use to sort of help supplement and fund these sort of projects. Could you tell me a little bit about how you'd tend to manage your time and how you choose some of your sort of projects?
Yeah, so at the moment, I am working in a warehouse and my shifts are 10 to 7. So 10 in the afternoon until 7 in the evening. And how I juggle that with the freelance stuff I do is it's just essentially when I get home from work at 7, half 7, I move into the editing side of things. So I'm doing some work with the PGMOL, which is the Board of Referees for the FA. They've recently started actively being on social media, on Twitter and Instagram. And they've been having webinar sessions about with different people from different backgrounds, just talking about the diversity within refereeing, as well as the referees itself. So I've been sorting out clips for them. I've also been helping out the Football Blacklist with some work as well, because they've been doing some great things, having hosting webinars as well. So I've been helping out here and there. So it's just something I do in the evening when I get home from the day job and just work through the night, and then I'm back at work the next day. So it's not ideal in terms of having to have the day job, but as you will well know, it's just got to be done essentially.
So the dream is to make it into a career in future.
Yes, that's the goal is to make it full time. Essentially, to have a team along with me, because it's not just about myself. I love to have people involved and working with me. A team is always something I've aspired to have in my job, no matter what the job actually is. I think that comes from my football days when I was younger, just being around the team and stuff. So essentially, that's what we want to do full time. I say we because I can't really mention freelance media without mentioning my friend James, who I met through uni. And together we've done a lot of the stuff that you see on freelance now. So, yeah.
So what sort When you started at Three Lights Media, what were your early projects? Were they sort of social, political, or was it always a plan to move down into sort of documenting sporting stories?
So essentially, the birth of Three Lights Media was between myself and six or seven other students that I went to uni with that met through uni in one way or another. And what we wanted to do was we wanted to provide opportunities for each other and anyone else who wanted to join to get into sports media. So some of them wanted to be journalists. Some of them wanted to work in sports marketing. Some of them wanted to do podcasting, content creation kind of thing. So essentially we came together just to create opportunities in sports media to then, if you had an interview, for example, you can say, I've got this experience, but I also made it myself. So that's essentially where it started, and it just progressed towards documentaries and stuff like that. There was seven of us in the beginning, I believe, but obviously life gets in the way and people get jobs in different areas and stuff. So essentially it's just been me and James, but two good friends of mine, Cheyenne and Pulo, have helped out here and there when they can as well. So that's how freelance actually started.
Yeah, it's awesome. And I guess without further ado, we should probably get on to the reason we're here. And that is the series Throwing the Kitchen Sink. So let's jump straight in by playing a short clip.
When in supermarkets, right, when they've got a new chocolate bar, for instance, to launch, what do? They put the chocolate bar right next to the till. You're switching on the TV and that chocolate bar is being advertised. And then you go into the supermarket to do your weekly shopping. You think, I've seen that. I tell you what, I'll try that one. It's right by the till right there. And what I would say is, if we're using that analogy in women's football, I don't think that we're putting women's football next to the till. I think it's there, but I think people have got to go down the aisles and they've got to try and find it. And I would even say that as far as I'm praising the FA player, I actually think there's a lot of people out there that don't even know it exists. I think there was a big thing around it when it first launched. And now I think people who already like women's football, who already would walk down the aisle to go and get their favourite food, are the ones that are using it. And what we need to do is get it by the till.
Lindsay's fantastic, isn't she? I've been very fortunate to spend some time working with the Offside Rule, and the stuff that they do is absolutely fantastic. But could you tell me about the clip and how you managed to set up the interview with Kate and Lindsay?
Yeah, so Lindsay, to share your point, is amazing, simply put. But I had initially contacted Lindsay, I think it was a year before I actually started filming for the documentary, regarding an event I was putting together about working in sports media and the kind of stories that you have. And I wanted her to be part of the panel I was organising. She couldn't make it on the day that we had set. So we had said on LinkedIn where we was talking that at some point we will work together. So then when I've had this idea, because I've already made the network with her, I asked her if she would want to be a part of it kind of stuff. So I told her the kind of reasoning behind Throwing the Kitchen Sink and that sort of thing. And she was like, yeah, I'd love to be on board. And she was really helpful in terms of linking me with Kate as well. And Hayley McQueen was also going to try and be in there as well. But as we keep saying, life got in the way. So it was just the two of them on the interview. But that's how they got involved. They was really helping us with giving us a push, both on their own personal platforms, but also on the Offside Rule pod as well. So, yeah, they've been nothing but great helping us out with what we needed to and pushing the documentary forward. And that clip in particular, I mean, the whole interview itself, there was loads of gems, but that clip in particular, yeah, that it's just a really powerful message that she said. And the analogy is great too. We did laugh at first because we wasn't sure where it was going to go. But once she had finished, the analogy made total sense.
It's perfect. It's absolutely perfect. But I realised that obviously we've just been chatting and I probably haven't really covered. There probably might be a few people still listening. So I've got all this, but what is Throwing the Kitchen Sink? So I guess I put that question to yourself.
Essentially, Throwing the Kitchen Sink is a five-part documentary series that looks at the stories of women's football. So by stories, I mean the good and the bad. So there's issues that we see within women's football and women's sport in general. And if you want to expand on that, how society views women as well. So this it highlights issues such as sexism, the equal pay debate, which can be expounded to wider society. But yeah, it's an overview of the different issues, the different stories and the different perspectives of women and women in football. So yeah.
So you've got sort of well over sort of like 2 to 3 hours worth of content there. Was it always intended to be a series?
From early memory, yes. I don't think I wanted to put it all in one documentary because I didn't want to feel like I had left something out or I had looked at one point more than the other. So by splitting it into its own episodes, it gave me a chance to say, I've given everything to this topic or episode or theme as much as the other ones. So I didn't want to leave anything short or leave anyone out kind of thing. So I tried my best to keep all the episodes at similar timing and everything. So I know that I've given everything to each theme.
So was the final product a fair reflection of what you initially set out to achieve, or did it change along the way?
I would say about 90%, only because it being in a pandemic and some of the people I was talking to, there was no access to actually film them in person. So this is just me being nitpicky with myself. It was just more of the fact that some of the calls had to be on Zoom, which I would have preferred it being otherwise, but you've just got to get on with it at some point. And no one's complained about it being on Zoom. And the quality and the information that I've got, it's still the same, whether it be on Zoom or whether it be in person. So I can't complain. I can't be too hard on myself in that regard.
Oh, definitely. You get a really good balance. You start off... and there's quite a few people that you do speak to in person, and I think there is a really nice little balance. And I don't think people think twice if they see a Zoom interview now, or if they haven't got that kind of professional BBC level of audio. I think people are, I hate the term new normal, but it almost is a bit of a new normal, which probably works well for myself, because when we first launched this podcast 3 years ago, it was all solely done in person. And we probably only did about 8 episodes because of the difficulties of getting together in person with people. So the fact that there's a real acceptance of the sort of Zoom, we use Squadcast, but the sort of similar sort of software to record, it's been a game changer. It's meant that the podcast has produced much more varied, diverse content, and it's not just me interviewing players from Southampton and Portsmouth because where I'm from. Like this probably wouldn't happen necessarily, or it would have happened a lot further down the line, and we'd have to try and meet somewhere in the middle and put diaries together. So I think, I certainly wouldn't nitpick yourself if you're talking about using Zoom. I don't think it detracts one little bit, and as I said at the top of the episode, I think what you produced is fantastic, and I certainly didn't notice the transition between your in-person interviews through to the Zoom work. So give yourself some credit on that one. So how did you start making the series? Because what comes first? Because as I said, you were still relatively new to women's football, so presumably you had to kind of think, right, I've got an idea of all of these topics. Who am I going to speak to? How did you open doors to speak to particular people? Did one interview then open doors for others and further future introductions?
The power of Twitter essentially is how I started. I follow a documenter called James Jones, and I approached him about my idea and where to start, and because initially I was asking about if I wanted to get it on TV, for example, who do I pitch to, or how do I go about pitching it to TV companies. So he gave me a lot of advice on how to write a pitch, what it should include, and then I did pitch it to a few TV companies. Not to say, oh, I want them to make it. I always had the intention of making it, and they just show it on TV. But I know some of them thought I was asking them to make it themselves. But yeah, that's how it started. So I just started with a pitch and a brief. And from then I started to think about who could be involved in what capacity. And then, as you said, with the networking, I can't remember who the first person was I contacted. I did have a few in mind. So like you, Drew Diamond from her football hub, for example. Sorry, I can't get my words out there. Because Drew is a really good friend of mine as well. So I contacted him, and through him and others like him, they said, oh, you should talk to this person, who referred me to another person. And I don't think we had an interview where they didn't suggest someone else. So I think we interviewed around 35 to maybe 40 people in total. And each one of those people said, oh, you should have, do you know this person? You should talk to this person. So if we had done that, there would have been hundreds of people for us to talk to. So once the ball started rolling, it didn't stop.
That's the power of the women's game. That network is fantastic. And it's Drew who could be credited with that, bringing my attention to the project, because he was an advocate of the project even before you were probably anywhere near completion. He was talking about it, sharing it. And like, those guys have done an amazing job. And with the amount of followers that they've now gained through their hard work and working with yourselves and the networks, it's just amazing. It's just so nice. But we could talk about how amazing the Women's Football Network is for hours. And I want to focus on you and this really great series that you've produced. So that's how you obviously started with regards to speaking to people. But I refer to you as a media producer and a content creator, mainly because you do everything pretty much, but you do it with the assistance of other people. So how did you go about recruiting people for all the jobs and roles required?
So pretty much everything you've seen done, apart from like the advertising side of things, has been produced by four or five people. So there's myself, and then there is my cousin Tamara, who was a great help with recording. And then, as I mentioned before, there's James, Pulo and Cheyenne. So between the five of us, the documentary has been produced between the five of us, essentially, without including the advertising, as I said before. And they're just friends of mine. I just said, I've got this project I'm trying to do. What do you think? Would you like to be a part of it? They said, yeah. Obviously, they added their ideas and stuff, and we just went from there. And it's really easy to create something like this when you're working with like-minded people. There was never any arguments about anything between anyone. There might have been arguments with myself over different things like quality and stuff. But essentially, between the five of us, we all just shared the vision of what we wanted to do. And we just done everything we could to make it as best as we could. In terms of like equipment, my uncle was a big help with that as well, because he did help me out a lot if I needed certain things, because he's got a side project on the media side that he was starting. So he was like, anything that you need in terms of that, I can try and help you the best I can.
Excellent. But, so you were able to borrow a lot of that equipment?
Most of the equipment was my own, or it was paid for by myself. But a few things here and there. So like some camera lenses that he had, he was able to give me. I was actually using my sister's camera at the start because I didn't have my own. So I had her help as well. And then my uncle had a camera that he wasn't using, so I was able to use that. And then I got my own camera in the end. So it's just a lot of support from family and friends that's helped us do it, because the documentary was funded by us, well, by myself. Like, I remember me and James used to use our free vouchers for a studio, a podcast studio, as a location to film for the documentary. Obviously, not with it being the global pandemic and everything, being in someone's house is a bit of a touch and go situation. So we was using free studio time to interview players and people for the documentary. So it was a lot of push and pull with the logistics of things, but we managed to get there in the end and produce what we have today.
So obviously you touched on the COVID pandemic. How did that affect producing the series? Because I'm aware that it all began well prior. Let's start again. You've obviously touched on COVID and the pandemic, but from what I'm led to believe is that you actually started working on this way before COVID hit. So what sort of impact did COVID have on producing the final product?
So the initial idea probably started, so we went into lockdown in March. The initial idea probably started around February time. And then it was actually in the middle of the first lockdown in June or July when I was like, yeah, this is something I'm definitely going to do. And we didn't complete filming until, when was it? February 2021, I think, in and around that kind of time frame.
I was under the impression that a lot of the in-person stuff was filmed prior to the pandemic. So a lot of that was actually done during that period last year, where actually it was a little bit more open, but just with safe practices.
Yeah, so everything you see in the documentary was filmed during the time COVID has been around. So obviously with social distancing and COVID protocols and stuff, we all adhere to those, but everything was recorded during the actual pandemic, which is crazy to think about now that we was able to interview so many people during that period of time. But essentially, if the pandemic wasn't a thing, we probably would have done filming in about no longer than 2 months probably, but because of COVID it was stretched out to about 8 months in total that it took to film everything.
So how did you find putting it together? Did you have to wait till you'd spoken to everybody so you knew what content you were working with, or you started to piece it together as you went?
A bit of both. So in my head, I had a rough idea of when I'm talking to a certain person, what I'm going to focus on more. So in my head, I had kind of pieced it together, but I didn't actually put episodes together until I had finished filming. Because I wanted to have a good overview of what everyone had said and see what works in each episode, rather than having this person in particular in one episode. And then when I review it, it doesn't really match, or someone said the same thing in a better way. So I just waited until all the filming was done and then pieced together what I'd already formulated in my head.
So there weren't too many people that were cut out then?
No, there wasn't. I think only one or two people were cut out. That's just because of the audio. You couldn't work out what they were saying, but everyone I could get in definitely got in. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and you really have some fantastic talent featured in the series. Could you just list a few of the awesome people that are featured?
Yeah, so we have Angra James, who's just gone to NC Courage. She was at Reading at the time. She's an amazing person, like really down to earth. So we had her in there. We had a good friend of mine, Tosin, who runs Sports Shifts. She's doing a lot of work there, making a really big point about making football or sports in general active place for Black people and especially Black women. So she's doing a lot of great work there. We had Hayley Bennett, who's a diversity and inclusion manager, who's done a lot of work with like women in football, for example. As we mentioned before, we had Drew Diamond in there, who is one of the founding members of Her Football Hub, and we know the great work he's done. And then we had the likes of Lindsay Hooper and Kate Borsay. I could go on for ages, but I feel like just because of the whole experience, the people at Lewis that invited us down to spend the day there with the players, we got to just hang around during their light training session and then interview three of the players, as well as having a sit down with the general manager, Maggie Murphy. That was a particular highlight for all of us. because where we had started, we wouldn't have envisioned being invited down to a club to film down there and just be a part of their day kind of thing.
They're absolutely brilliant at Lewis, aren't they? I kind of imagine that you probably had enough content to produce an episode in itself. I know you spoke to Katie and Rhianne, and the stories that they can tell. Yeah, have you got enough to do a follow-up on that one, a DVD extra, if you will?
Yeah, actually, I feel like with everyone we interview, we could probably do an episode in itself. I think each interview was probably around 30 to 45 minutes. And obviously, you have to try and squeeze everything of what they've said into 25, 28-minute episodes. So it was a challenge knowing when to cut off what people had said. But yeah, Lewis in particular, they had so much information on what the prominent problems within women's football, but not also the problems, how to get around those problems as well. So it wasn't just a whinge fest, for example. It was, this is the issue and this is how we can fix it. And a lot of the stuff that they say about how to fix it is stuff that they're already doing as well. So Lewis is definitely a shining light within women's football.
Yeah, they're really proactive when it comes to a lot of these themes, and they really are a leading light, and it's hard not to become a fan of theirs after experiencing them. The Dripping Pan as a stadium in itself, if many of our listeners haven't been there, it's fantastic. I describe it as a tour through football history. You've got a lovely little seat, a stand. You've got a raised hill, which you literally will get people up there with their dogs. You've got an old-fashioned terrace stand supplemented by a brand-new, ultra-modern terraced area with a fantastic little bar. And it's just a brilliant experience. I went about two or three seasons ago for their opening game of the season. Beautiful August, September afternoon. And it was just a great experience. And from now on, and hopefully until the day I die, all going well, I want to spend the first home game of every season at the Dripping Pan watching Lewis, because it's just such a great experience. And if you can make it down to catch up with them, then I'll treat you to a beer.
Yeah, I've actually, how many times did I watch Lewis play last season? I think it was two or three times I had watched them play. I watched their first game when they were allowed fans back during the pandemic. So that was an experience in itself. Everyone had their pans with them to celebrate any goals. And they actually won that day. They won 2-0. So definitely I will look forward to meeting you on the first game of the season. I will definitely try and make it there.
Definitely, because I drew a beer as well. So yeah, we'll see if we can make that happen. But was there anyone that you'd hoped to speak to that just you weren't able to in the end?
So I did want to try and get a manager of a club in any capacity. I wanted to try and get a manager just to ask them questions about how they feel about women's football and the kind of issues surrounding it. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. I did contact a few and there was a few talks here and there, but it just couldn't work out. And I did want to try and interview some more players in the WSL. We did interview two in Angara James and Maz Pacheco at West Ham. Obviously, Natasha Flint's now a WSL player with Leicester going up, but she wasn't at the time. We did try and contact some WSL players and stuff, but it just didn't work out for one reason or another. But apart from that, I feel like I covered every other kind of category, if you want to call it, of people I wanted in the documentary 100%.
And I think what was quite a nice touch is that you spoke to people from outside of the women's game, but within sporting media, and it was really good to hear their views about women's football, because there's a few that are quite honest and say, well, I'm no expert in women's football, but... And they still come out with some really good, valid points, especially when it comes to the episode 3, which is the race and sport. But actually, that's probably a good little point. Let's talk about some of the episodes and the issues raised. So you've got five episodes. Are you able just to list the topic of each episode for our listeners?
Yes. Yeah, so we had The equal pay debate, which is obviously probably the most prominent theme within women's football or women's sport in general, the fact that men are always paid more than the women in some capacity. So, yeah, we had that one. We had broadcasting problems, which was looking at the fact that up until when the news was announced this year, WSL games and especially the championship games weren't broadcasted on BBC or ITV like the men's game is. So we looked at why that is, why broadcasters aren't taking into consideration how popular women's football actually is. There was sexism and sexuality in football. So there's a common misconception that every women's footballer is lesbian. So I wanted to investigate that and see the perspective of those involved in women's football, both as players and outside, how they feel about that kind of stereotype and stuff. Then we had diversity, the lack of black representation in women's football. Diversity is something that hits home for me being a black man. And I felt it was really important to include that because women's football, especially in the UK, it's hard to see other black women in the game. In the WSL, there's maybe a handful of black players in the league, and in the championship there's a little bit more, but I feel like it's maybe 10 off the top of my head that I can think of. So I thought it was important to acknowledge that, not just on the field but off the field. And Lindsay Hooper, for example, mentioned about the excellence centres in grassroots football and the lack of representation there. So it wasn't just about, oh, this is not good enough kind of thing. It was trying to find out why this is happening and stuff. So I thought that was really important. And lastly, we was looking at agency, because obviously both in men's football and in women's football, sports agents are looked at quite negatively. People seeing them as money merchants, that just about getting a paycheck for themselves. But there's a lot of people who do the same job, but do it essentially to look after their clients, who turn out to be friends. It's not just a business transaction between two people. There is a substantial relationship between an agent and their client. So I felt like it was important to have a look at that too. And agency within women's football isn't something that's investigated a lot either. So I thought that definitely be an interesting thing to look at.
Yeah, and it's the sort of thing that does need to be talked about and promoted, because I think you're a perfect example, because I know the work you've done with Sterling and Amber Stobbs. You've created a good little network there yourself. That's another video that I'd probably like to signpost people to. You've done a fantastic 30-minute interview with Amber, who's known by many as a top-quality footballer, but also slightly further afield from being a footballer that's spoken quite honestly about her sort of mental health challenges that she's needed to overcome. So if you're listening to this, once you've watched Throw in the Kitchen Sink, definitely make sure you watch that episode as well. But it just goes to show that actually when you build those relationships, they're not just with players, they're with content creators, they're with clubs, and there's a lot of loyalty there as well. So I look forward to seeing other content that you'll produce in partnership with Sterling and other agencies. But I know through a few of the agents that I do speak to on a regular basis, they are nothing like the reputation that many have from the men's game. Many have their phones on 24/7 supporting the female players, and I can't sort of commend the great work that they do. They do enough. They go above and beyond on a regular basis.
Yeah, 100%. I'm in regular contact with David Fernhead, who was also in the documentary as well, who represents Natasha Flynn and Gareth James. And he actually was so helpful with setting up those interviews with those two players in particular. But I know how much work he does and how how much effort he has to put in to make sure that his players are performing the best that they can. Obviously, there is a lot of onus on the players to go on the pitch and perform. But I know through talking to those players in particular, the standard that David has set means that even if they're going through anything, they always have him to rely on as well. So I feel like that's something that people overlook when it comes to agents. Obviously, not all agents are like that. Some are just about the money and stuff because you do hear those stories. But I feel like it's important to give flowers to those who deserve it as well.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. But obviously, they're all fantastic themes that are all very relevant and all possess, they're all issues that do need to be tackled. Is there one particular one that you think is the most important that needs to be overcome?
I would say I'm tied with two. So one's more of like a professional aspect and one's like a personal. So obviously from a personal standpoint, I would say the black representation is the one that's the most important to me, because that's something that I have to live with every day as well. So I feel like from a personal standpoint, I would always suggest that one. From a professional standpoint or from a content standpoint, it would be the broadcasting problems. Obviously, we've seen an upturn in advertisement and broadcasting now with this new deal coming in next season. But at the time, this news hadn't come through. So a lot of the opinions that you see in the documentary are before this announcement was made public. So it's good to see that the progress is being made. Obviously, there's a lot of steps that need to go, and then the benefits of it going towards grassroots football and etc., which we will see over time. But yeah, I feel like from a professional standpoint, that was probably the most important one to me.
While it is great news, I must admit, I don't think that this TV deal goes far enough. I found it quite humorous that the BBC were being given so much applause for the work that they've done in this new TV deal, when they've had access to a lot of these games for quite some time now, but they've still been hiding them on the red button instead of putting them front and centre of BBC One and BBC Two. So I definitely think that they could have done more. But that's not to say that the BBC haven't been a positive influence, because the website is making huge strides, even just keeping people up to date with scores and live minute by minute. So they are doing a great job, but I still don't think it goes all the way to really filling all the gaps that are needed. I have reservations about Sky's sensationalised 24-hour coverage, but we'll see what happens. Hopefully we don't lose the heart of women's game and it doesn't become a carbon copy of the men's game. But fundamentally, we all want to see more women's football. We can't get out to see it in person. So it is going to be a positive thing, but hopefully it's just the first step into the women really getting the money that they deserve. And hopefully in 10 years' time, we'll look back and we'll laugh at how small this TV deal is and rejoice in how big the future deals are.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like Lindsay's analogy is exactly what you were just saying there. Like the fact it's in the shop, it's just towards the back. It's not right in front of your face kind of thing. So I feel like there is definitely more to be done. But we can see some sort of progress on paper, at least. It's just to now see the results of it. And hopefully it transpires to a position where we're all happy with it.
Yeah, definitely. Because I think the more people get to watch women's football, the more they'll appreciate it. I know I've had friends that I've taken to matches and they've had no prior knowledge, probably had a few unfair preconceptions of women's football, but what they've enjoyed the most is just the entertainment. And it doesn't matter what level you're talking about in the women's football pyramid. You've got high scoring, entertaining games at every single level, where you and I both grew up obviously focusing on men's football. Quite often men's football games are pretty boring, to be honest. You get the odd little moment of magic, but for me it's not like that in the women's game. The games are much more entertaining. So I do think that if people can watch them, I think while there are small-minded arsehole trolls that you'll see on Twitter, the vast majority of football fans are actually quite open-minded. And if you give them that product or exposure to that product, I think they'll definitely be a lot more appreciative of it. And hopefully the Euros, being based in the UK and in England next year, I think that will go a long way to making some changes. If there's still a hangover of COVID, then we might well find that there'll be more UK fans within grounds. I hope that we it's not quite like that, and we do get to allow and welcome some of the other supporters in the country just to add to the atmosphere. But I'm really excited by what we're going to see over the next sort of 2, 3, 4 years. I think the landscape is just going to look so different when we listen back to this episode, and when we catch up in a couple of years, and when you go back to look at these same themes and see how they've progressed, even in the space of 2 years, hopefully you're going to see that there is going to be big changes. And I'd be interested for you to actually go back and look at some of these topics and see how they've changed, because I think they will, and I think for the better.
Yeah, 100%. I was going to say the for me personally, the unique selling point surrounding women's football is, yes, the games are competitive, and if you're someone who hasn't been aware of women's football, the quality of football is a lot better than you might expect. But also off the pitch, the stories behind these players are so open, first of all. Like, it's available for anyone to find out if you really want to find them out, whereas in the men's, stories are usually quite guarded, or if the stories do come out about certain players, they're often negative. If a good story comes out about a men's player, it's really blown out of proportion. Whereas you find these great stories about women's footballers often, like, common, it's a common cause within women's football. And just like the people are so personable, you very rarely meet a media-trained women's footballer, which means they're more approachable. You can just have a general conversation.
So honest.
Yeah, exactly. So it's really good insight. So I'll give you an example. Angara James, she was at international duty when we had our interview, hence why she had her Wales tracksuit on. And aside from the interview, she was telling me about her cause for recycling and climate change and worrying about the environment. And she said that within the Wales camp, she had spoke to the board about the use of plastic bottles, and she wanted to try and implement reusable bottles for the players and staff at the team. And that's not something you would have expected to hear from a footballer. I'm not saying that no men's footballer cares about the environment, but it's not something that you would think would come up in conversation.
Yeah, it wouldn't be considered newsworthy. And that when I talk about my reservations about Sky's sensational 24-hour coverage, they've got no interest in really covering that. Or at least if they do have an interest, they seem to choose not to, because, as you say, there's probably a lot of good work. Marcus Rashford probably isn't the first footballer to do good work outside of football, but these people, these organisations, they don't talk about it enough. And I do feel that women's football is more progressive. It's a fact, really, isn't it? It is progressive in so many ways.
Yeah, 100%. Obviously, with all things, there's work to do, but I do find the topics and the issues that you see in women's football are dealt with a lot quicker, or accepted a lot quicker than there would be in men's football.
Yeah, definitely. So, is there a plan to maybe go back and look at some of these topics in future? Is that something you'd like to do?
Yes. So at the end of episode 5, we did say that Throwing the Kitchen Sink will return. We do have some ideas about how it's going to return. Not to give too much away, it might not be in documentary form. It might be in a different form. So, yeah, we are working behind the scenes to create more stuff that way. But you just have to wait and see.
Cool. I look forward to it. I'm really excited about what the sort of content you produce, because I learned a lot through the episodes, and it was a great insight to people that I follow through social media. So to hear them talk and speak to them, I think it was fantastic. Is there anything that you learned from your experience that you would use in future projects?
Yeah, to be more organized. Essentially, I probably wrote the story of how I wanted it to look 100 times. I was flicking through loads of notebooks, just about what kind of transition I want to make between this episode, whether I wanted to do a different episode altogether, what people was going to be in each episode. So there was just loads of paper everywhere, and it wasn't a very streamlined operation. So there's little things here and there that I could have done to make it a lot easier for me in the long run, because post-production was a really big task. But we got there in the end, and I'm happy with the results, so I can't complain too much. But yeah, being more organized would be the one thing I would do moving forward.
Yeah, it must have been so difficult. You must have had to have been so ruthless with some of that content.
Literally, like, it's really hard to know when to cut off a certain point, because the challenge was, if someone had said something really good, but someone else had said the same point but in a different way, do I just have the clip from one person, or do I find a way to fit both clips in? So it was stuff like that that was really hard to decipher. But yeah, we got there in the end, and I can't complain at all.
The final product is something that you should definitely be proud of, and I think women's football is richer for having storytellers like yourself involved, as too many of these stories have gone untold for too long.
Thank you. And I feel like I can't just take the credit for myself. Like, I do have to thank all the people who were involved, obviously the people we interviewed. Obviously, if they're not involved, I don't have a documentary to edit and put out. So everyone involved in terms of the interviews, the people that you did see, as well as the people you didn't see. So James Lewis, as I mentioned before, my cousin Tamara, Pulo, who helped out with the questions and the different themes and how we was going to go about the interviews with different people. He was really integral to that. And Cheyenne helping behind the scenes, even though she had some difficult circumstances at the time as well, she still was able to help us. So 100% those people deserve a shout out. And then even people like yourself, Stuart, like contacting me after the documentary had been out and wanting to have me on the podcast, I can't undersell how important platforms like Since 71 and Her Football Hub have been with sharing our stories and stuff. More so than people who claim to be champions of women's football, like the big publications and some of their writers haven't even engaged with our content. So it only emphasizes how important Since 71 and Her Football Hub have been towards us.
Thank you. It's really kind of you to say. I do think that volunteer fan produced content is really important in pushing the women's game forward. And I do think that there isn't hopefully going to be avenues for people like yourself and myself and everyone in the future, so that actually it doesn't have to be a hobby or a passion piece, and it can become a living. I'm 38 next year, and I always think that I don't know if I could really do a career change, but who knows? Who knows what doors will open in the future as women's football continues to develop. For the benefit of our listeners, where can they find the series?
So if you go on YouTube and you type in Threelance Media, we should be the top suggestion for Threelance Media. And you click on our page and you'll be able to see all our episodes there. We're also active on social media, on Twitter and Instagram. Our Instagram is at threelancemedia__, because there's been a mix-up with the previous page we had. And on Twitter, we are at threelancemedia. So, yeah, just go on any of those. There'll definitely be links to our documentary there.
Yeah, and we obviously you've got the rise in smart TVs now, so everyone's got access to YouTube, so they can sit there and watch it in the comfort of their own home. So make sure that you do go out and do exactly that. And just to clarify one thing, it's actually the number 3 Lance Media, the character, and not freelance, just in case you do get confused and you're getting frustrated in your searches.
Yes, thank you for clearing up. I always forget to mention that it's 3 Lance Media. I'm so used to saying it with 3, but I often say YouTube is the best resource in the world at the moment, that it's impossible to not find what you're looking for on YouTube. That could be from a content perspective or just something as simple as putting up a shelf. So I really love the fact that people like myself, content creators, have control over what they want to put out and how they want to put it out, whereas before you would have to wait and see it on TV kind of thing. But YouTube has given access to people to take control of their own narrative. And I feel like that's important because that's how stories like these get about, rather than relying on someone else to do it for you by chance.
For visual creators, it's almost like the revolution that happened for musicians with MySpace, isn't it? It really does give you that power of control about how you can put that product out there, and it's easily consumable by followers, I suppose, if for want of a better word.
Yeah, it's exactly like no one can tell you what you can and can't put out, obviously within reason. So the power of controlling your own narrative is something that's empowering, and it gives, but it also inspires others to do the same or do something completely different. Like, you never know who it's going to touch or what impact it may have. So like the documentary itself, it's not something I see as this is to benefit me. It's to hopefully someone else to watch it and then take inspiration from it and do what they want to do with it or take it into a different direction. So having that kind of power in your own production is something I'm always going to be an advocate for.
Yeah, definitely. It's priceless. But I'm mindful that I've kept you for sort of well over an hour now. So again, thank you for giving up your evening and being patient with me to actually make us get to have a chance to get together and make this happen. It's very much appreciated.
Absolutely. Anytime. I've had so much fun talking to you, even beforehand, just like speaking on text and stuff like that. So another person I can successfully add to my network, and I'll hopefully see you in August/September for Lewis's first home game.
Yeah, definitely. And I wait the invite for season 2. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. So thank you again for everyone for listening. You may have noticed at the beginning of the show, we've substituted out our regular theme tune to replace it with Rain by AT, which is the number 80 as opposed to Alpha Tango. And this is the theme tune that Ajani's actually used to throw in the kitchen sink. So before we do go, could you just tell us a very little bit about AT and how you came about to using this?
Yeah, so I would say about 90% of the music you hear in the documentary is produced by friends of mine. So it's between 2 of them. So you've got 3 of them. 80, my friend Nathaniel, or Envy, as he's registered in the music space, and my other friend Ashley Zeal. And the 3 of them make music respectively. And yeah, I wanted it to be something that's inclusive, to something that everyone can take from it. So it's not a situation where I've used the most popular artists and paid to use their music. These are friends of mine who are perfecting their craft and making good music at the same time, but they're not at the level they want to be, but I feel like their music deserves to be. So I wanted to include that in the documentary and say, this is something that you're a part of now as well.
Definitely, it's to be commended. And so no further ado, I say goodbye to you. I say goodbye to everyone. As I said at the beginning, hopefully you'll be back with us very soon for our Olympic content. And we're always putting a handful of articles out on the website. So do keep an eye out, and do make sure to give us a follow online. if you want to find out how you can follow Ajani and you could catch it earlier, then it will all be linked in the show notes. So take care, everyone. Stay safe and enjoy the rest of the Euros for the men's football while we're sat here waiting for the women's to come back. Take care. Bye-bye.